Tune Review and Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @TuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@tunereview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 22nd of September 2023, from the news section. Location of first proposed safe drug consumption room revealed. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The proposed location of Scotland's first government-sanctioned safe drugs consumption facility has been revealed. Plans state that this first facility will be based in Glasgow's Hunter Street. Documents presented to Glasgow's Council and Health Board say it will be open between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. 365 days a year at the Hunter Street Health Centre, which already provides a heroin-assisted treatment service. The Scottish Government has agreed to make up to £2.3 million a year available for the Safer Drugs Consumption Facility, SDCF, pilot, with staff coming on board in 2024 to 2025. First proposed in 2016, the facility aims to reduce the harms associated with drug use in public areas. Earlier this month, the plans moved closer to reality, as the Lord Advocate said it would not be in the public interest to prosecute people in such facilities for drugs possession. The Home Office also said it would not impede the consumption room pilot from going ahead. A report going before the Integration Joint Board noted that the consumption facility was likely to polarise opinion. It said, SDCFs have been shown to reduce public injecting and discarded needles and remove barriers to and improve the uptake into treatment and care. The report said the Hunter Street site offers a discrete base closely located to the city centre, and implementation of the enhanced drug treatment service within the centre has not caused significant challenges for the community. Glasgow's Health and Social Care Partnership will cover the costs of redesigning the building, creating a reception and injecting area with booths as well as treatment rooms and a recovery area. The report said the SDCF will be subject to a robust independent evaluation studying the impact on service users, staff, local communities and businesses, and whether anticipated wider societal benefits such as cost reductions in other services are realised. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday the 22nd of September 2023, from the news section. Onshore wind farms deals to be streamlined by Scottish Government. This article is written by Ross Hunter. The Scottish Government has pledged to speed up application decisions on new onshore wind farms as part of a deal with the renewables sector. Wellbeing Economy Secretary Neil Gray signed the deal on Thursday at the Scottish Renewables Onshore Wind Conference in Edinburgh. The agreement will see decisions for new farms accelerated to a maximum of 1 year when there is no public inquiry required, and 2 years when one is held. The government claims this will cut decision times in half by streamlining the process and improving the format of applications. Scotland is also set to become a world leader in the recycling and repurposing of wind turbine blades, the government said, with the creation of a specialist facility pledged for 2030. After signing the deal, Gray said, "This deal is a practical example of government and industry working closely together to reinforce our shared commitment to reaching net zero. As we embrace the possibilities, we acknowledge the challenges that lie ahead. Balancing the needs of energy production with proper environmental stewardship demands diligence and continuous innovation. This deal charts a course that safeguards our natural heritage while delivering clean, affordable energy to power our lives and industries. By benefiting communities, we are ensuring the rewards of our onshore wind revolution are shared by all. This helps meet our programme for government commitments and create a green and growing economy with fairness at its heart." Greens Minister Lorna Slater, who worked in the renewables industry before entering government, said the deal will see more wind farms, more communities benefiting, and more economic opportunity, while ensuring developments are in harmony with our environment. Scottish Renewables Chief Executive Claire Mack described the deal as a huge day, adding, "A world leader in renewable energy, Scotland has an ambition for onshore wind to have 20 gigawatts of onshore wind by 2030, and the onshore wind sector deal will play a key role in helping us hit this target." An incredible amount of hard work has gone into making this deal happen, and it is a real benefit to the industry, knowing that the time onshore wind farm take to go through planning will be halved to only 12 months. It is also encouraging to see onshore wind farm operators and the Scottish Government committed to creating a sustainable solution and a circular economy supply chain for the recycling of wind turbine component parts. "We look forward to working closely with the Scottish Government to ensure the onshore wind sector deal is effectively implemented on the road to achieving Scotland's net zero ambitions. The deal will also ensure companies engage with local communities early in the development of wind farms and offer impactful community benefits, as well as an industry pledge to create skilled jobs, including apprenticeships, in Scotland." That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday the 22nd of September 2023, from the news section. School strikes to go ahead in Scotland as union rejects pay offer. This article is written by Ross Hunter. Schools across much of Scotland are set to close next week after a union rejected the best and final pay offer from council leaders. The Convention of Scottish Local Authorities, COSLA, said its significantly improved in-year offer would mean workers on the Scottish Local Government Living Wage see an in-year uplift of around £2,000, or almost 10%. But Unison, one of three unions involved in the negotiations, said strikes will go ahead as it has rejected the deal. School staff, including cleaners and janitors, will walk out for 3 days from Tuesday. However, according to the PA News Agency, Unison has rejected the offer, but will put it before members, suggesting that they also reject it. An extra £90 million was found for the latest offer, including the £10 million previously allocated by council leaders in the previous deal offered to unions on September the 13th. COSLA said the new offer was made on condition that the unions take it to their members for full consideration, and that strikes are suspended with immediate effect whilst they do so. Its resources spokeswoman, Katie Hagman, said, "I am extremely disappointed with Unison that not only are they recommended rejection of this £500 million pay package, they are putting our communities, especially children and young people, through the turmoil and mayhem of strikes next week. This best and final offer was made on the basis that strikes would be suspended. Throughout negotiations, council leaders have reiterated the value we place on the workforce and the work that they do. It is totally unacceptable with such a significant offer on the table. We are talking about a pay package worth over £445 million, specifically targeted at the lower end of our workforce, which not only compares well to other sectors, but recognises cost of living pressures. The lowest paid would see an in-year uplift of over £2,000, or just under 10%. This would mean that a pupil support assistant currently earning £22,000 would receive £2,006 increase and a new salary of £24,000. This is an additional £748 from the offer in April. Unions have warned that more than three quarters of schools will close if the strike goes ahead, affecting 26 of Scotland's 32 council areas. Unison, Unite and GMB Scotland rejected the previous measly pay offer from Cosler, saying it would lead to an increase of 38p per week for the lowest paid. Cosler had said the previous offer would have provided at least a £1,929 increase in annual salary for workers by January the 1st, and the lowest paid would have seen a 21% rise over 2 years. Hagman said on Thursday that no new money had been identified for the latest offer, and there will be delays to programmes and projects within communities to meet the pay demands. Keir Greenaway, GMB Scotland's senior organiser in public services, said on the new offer, "Our members have absolutely no interest in last-minute deadline dramas. All they want is a fair pay offer." Cosler could have made such an offer months ago, but instead, despite our best efforts, chose to drag the process out for no good reason. "We will now look to the detail of this latest offer. If it is a significant improvement on the last one, we will take it to our members. If it is not, the strikes will go ahead as planned." Unite has been asked for comment. That article was written by Ross Hunter. This is from The National on Friday the 22nd of September 2023, from the comments section. What Rishi Sunak got wrong and how Scotland can get it right. This article is written by Professor Richard Murphy. Rishi Sunak was forced into making a speech yesterday because its content had already been leaked. To summarise that content, Sunak is rowing back on the UK's climate change commitments because, he says, we are already ahead of the worldwide pack on this issue. That is, despite the fact that this government's own climate change committee has made it clear that existing commitments are way short of those required to achieve net zero by 2050. Bizarrely, Sunak claimed his speech was not political, and as such created, in his opinion, a new era of political honesty. Those claims were amongst the many abuses of the truth that the speech contained. Another such abuse was that he wants an honest debate on this issue. His legislation clamping down on protests suggests otherwise. As is typical from a fan of the far right, he wants a debate so long as all those taking part agree with him. His description of those who think climate change is a serious threat as extremists does not suggest a willingness on his part to embrace a range of views on this issue. Instead, three things characterised the speech. The first was an absence of any new money to solve this crisis, a small increase in the support for those installing heat pumps apart. In the face of the biggest climate, diversity, economic and social crisis that the planet has ever faced, Sunak is determined that the government should be notable by its absence from any arena where necessary change will actually take place. The second was his emphasis on the market. Apparently, consumers are to decide the pace at which climate change will be tackled. This, however, is impossible. As an example, those who buy electric vehicles are dependent upon the creation of charging networks, and ultimately those require public investment, but he's not going to provide it. The consumer cannot decide in that case. Third, there were straightforward misrepresentations of facts. No one has proposed a tax on meat. nor has there been a serious proposal for each house to have 7 recycling bins. There has never been an intention to enforce car sharing, and there is no tax on flying, although there should be. Despite that, Sunak claimed that he was abolishing each of these. Those claims were false. Most particularly, though, he claimed that the UK is on track with its climate change commitments. Its own climate change committee strongly disagrees. Sunak's new politics is, then, the same as his old one. It is all based on repeating claims that are not true as often as possible. Where does that leave Scotland? First of all, it makes clear that a vote for the Tories is a vote for climate disaster. Second, it also makes clear that there is no new politics of honesty as yet, however much we might beg for it. Third, given that Labour has already said it will not reinstate all the abandoned targets, this provides the SNP and other pro-independence parties with an opportunity to promote a serious agenda for both climate and economic change in Scotland. Sunak made no proper mention of any new commitment to wind or tidal power yesterday. Scotland can, however, deliver far more of both of these. Together they could form the foundation of the prosperity of an independent Scotland. That, of course, is no doubt the reason why Sunak did not mention them. If, however, those parties seeking independence want to create real division between them and Labour and the Tories, this is the fault line that they will have to exploit. Net zero may look like a threat to a small-minded English politician like Sunak. It should look like an opportunity to anyone who believes in Scotland. For Scotland, renewable energy will be the foundation of its prosperity, the basis of support for its currency, a major source of exports, and the way in which a lower cost of living can be delivered. Scotland may be unique in this way, but the good politician seeks to exploit unique opportunities. Scotland needs to demand better and more investment when it comes to net zero. Anyone who believes in an independent Scotland has to say so time and again. Sunak won't deliver, and Labour is dithering. That is the fault line in Scottish politics now. It is there to be exploited. That article was written by Professor Richard Murphy.
This is from The National on Monday, 25th September 2023, from the News section. Horrific vandalism of Scottish Yes Hub investigated by police. By Xander Elliards. Police are probing a horrific attack on a Yes Hub in a Scottish city. The Inver Yes Hub in Inverness was targeted by an unknown vandal in the small hours of Saturday morning in an attack members allege was politically motivated. First of all, we were horrified. Then you sort of go through the different stages of grief, Judith Reid, who works with the Hub, said. You go from being horrified to being angry, and then determined. I think we're all pretty much determined now just to show them that regardless of who did this, that we are absolutely determined to carry on, that we won't be bullied or harassed or victimised. We will carry on. Reid said it was not a stone but a boulder that had been used to smash the door panels and windows, which have since been boarded up with the Yes signage put on the exterior. Some artworks and other items inside the Hub were also damaged in the attack. Can you imagine what it would have been like if this had been another group targeted? Reid asked, suggesting that if unionists had been attacked, then the Yes side would find itself widely demonised. The incident disrupted a meeting planned for Saturday to finalise arrangements for a wellbeing walk around Inverness, held on the final weekend of each month. Instead, members met on the street outside, where Reid said the backing from the public was strong. They were just so supportive, she told The National. It's been very good in the sense that people have come forward and said that they're more than happy to give any donations towards the cost of a recovery and repair. So it's turned something horrific into something that is positive and driven. Reid added, "To be perfectly honest, I think everybody that goes to the Inverness Hub has got an emotional attachment to it because we put so much hours and dedication into it." The Inverness Hub posted on Facebook about the incident and received supportive messages in reply, including offering to help or donate to fix the damage. It is understood that conversations are ongoing with insurers and the building owner, and only once concluded will decisions on how to fund repairs be taken. A Police Scotland spokesperson said, "We received a report of the windows at the premises on Huntley Street, Inverness, being smashed around 2:20 a.m. on Saturday, 23rd September 2023. Inquiries are ongoing." That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National on Monday, 25th September 2023, from the Politics section. Land reform calls after US developers buy up more Scottish land. By Xander Elliards. A Labour MSP has demonstrated outside a resort snapped up by the Teignmouth Castle developers in a bid to highlight the weakness of the Scottish Government's land reform proposals. Mercedes Villalba took her protest to Moaness Resort in Aberfeldy over the weekend in the wake of the news that it had been acquired by Discovery Land Company, or DLC, a firm which specialises in luxury private holiday compounds for the mega-rich. The 35-acre Moaness Resort adds to the US firm's extensive portfolio of Scottish land, which includes the 450-acre Teignmouth Castle and grounds, the neighbouring 7,000-acre Glenlyon Estate, Kenmore Hotel, Kenmore Post Office and Shop, Teignmouth Trading, Bray Cottages, Amfasgath and Gatehouse, Paperboat, Police House and the Boathouse Cottages. As it stands, the Scottish Government's proposed land reform bill would see a public interest test triggered on sales or transfers of land of more than 3,000 hectares. As such, even the largest of DLC's purchases, the 2,800-hectare Glenlyon Estate, would not be covered. Speaking outside the Moaness Resort, Labour MSP Villalba said, "Scotland's been carved up without our say. It's our land. It should work in all our interest. That's why I'm taking the campaign for land justice to Discovery Land Company, who are buying up vast swathes of Scotland to create a private playground for the mega rich." DLC have insisted they will not be creating a gated community at Teignmouth as they have elsewhere in the world. But questions for the US firm remain, specifically around their environmental commitments. Villalba went on, "The Scottish Government's proposal for land reform are far too timid. They offer no route for the public to challenge existing holdings like this one. SNP and Green MSPs must get behind my proposals to ensure Scotland's land works for in all our interest and to address the centuries-old concentrated pattern of land ownership in Scotland." The Labour MSP is aiming to cut the threshold for a public interest test on land sales from 3,000 hectares to 500. Land reform expert Dr. Callum MacLeod has called for a land reform bill to also introduce such tests when key community assets, such as post offices or jetties, are up for sale. A consultation is currently open on Villalba's bill, and she has urged as many people as possible to take part before it closes at 1 minute to midnight on September 26th. If you haven't yet taken part in the consultation, please use your voice and have your say today, she said. That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National on Monday, 25th September 2023, from the Politics section. Scottish school strikes set to go ahead as weekend engagement fails. By Laura Pollock. Strikes in 24 of Scotland's local authorities are set to go ahead this week after councils and a trade union failed to reach an agreement over the weekend. Unison was the only major union not to suspend 3 days of action among its non-teaching school staff planned to begin on Tuesday 25th after a new deal was put on the table. Unite and the GMB union both cancelled strikes to put the offer from the local authority body COSLA to members, while Unison opted to ballot staff while continuing action. It is understood there was correspondence between the two parties over the weekend, but no new offer was made. Mark Ferguson, the chair of Unison Scotland's local government committee, said, "Unison is continuing with school strikes unless something significant comes from COSLA in the next hours. We have tried to talk to COSLA over the weekend, but problems still remain. Unison's commitment to winning a £15 per hour minimum rate for all local government roles has still not been satisfactorily addressed. And the failure to provide any new money to back this offer means further cuts to jobs and services. Unison will not accept a position where the union is asked to trade pay for jobs and services." No one takes the decision to strike lightly, but Unison believes that council workers in Scotland deserve far better than this. "I know the inconvenience these strikes will cause. I am a parent myself. But if we don't take a stand, then the longer term impact to our children and communities is going to get far worse." The new offer represents a minimum wage increase of £2,006 for those on the Scottish Government's living wage and a minimum increase of £1,929 for workers who are earning above the living wage. The living wage of £10.85 will rise to £11.89 under the new offer, equivalent to a 9.6% increase. The pay offer is estimated to cost roughly £580 million. That article was by Laura Pollock.
From The National, Monday the 25th of September, from the comment section: Grant Shapps and Rishi Sunak give a taste of what's next for the Tories. Article by Kirsty Strickland. If a camel is a horse designed by committee, then Grant Shapps is what would happen if a cabinet minister was produced using the same process. As we saw during his disastrous Sunday morning media round, Shapps is just the right level of shameless to be the spokesperson for Rishi Sunak's new strategy of pissing voters off as much as possible before he announces the date of the next general election. Of course, the Prime Minister wouldn't characterise it in such a way. His new slogan is, "Long-term decisions for a brighter future," which is an odd thing for a party that has been in power for the last 14 years to promise. You have to wonder how much the longer voters are expected to commit to the Conservative Party before they start to see some positive results. Though, I suppose, "vote for us and we promise to stop breaking things" isn't as catchy a strapline. This new direction from the Prime Minister puts you in mind of a boyfriend that strings his girlfriend along through her best childbearing years before concluding that the chemistry just isn't there. The sunlit uplands promised by the Prime Minister might be more easily imagined if his party hadn't spent the last decade allowing a series of misfits and sociopaths to have a shot at running the country. Anyway, back to Shapps, who was tasked with explaining this nonsense to the masses. He defended the Prime Minister's decision to delay net zero targets, explaining to a somewhat bemused Victoria Derbyshire that nothing had in fact changed. When she referenced comments he had made earlier in the year when he said that 2030 would be the end of new petrol and diesel,
He told her that 2035 was always the planned date for the final phase-out. According to Shapps, everything is ticking along nicely and as it should. You have to wonder, then, why the Prime Minister had decided to hold an unexpected press conference last week to make the announcement that had, according to Shapps, already been announced. Maybe the Prime Minister just had a look at the party's most recent polling numbers and decided that he wants to play at being a leader as much as possible before he's inevitably chucked out, along with the rest of his mediocre colleagues. Shapps was also asked to explain reports that Rishi Sunak is planning to scrap the northern section of the HS2 high-speed rail line next weekend. His response? You guessed it, and you'll be hearing a lot more of it in the months to come. The Prime Minister is prepared to take difficult long-term decisions. Whatever happened to the levelling up agenda? For a while, that was the slogan of the day, and you couldn't turn on your television without seeing a red-faced middle-aged Tory spouting it in response to every question they were asked. At the time, the levelling up agenda was meant to be the thing that sorted the Conservative Party's most recent bout of social and civic destruction. You'd always find it referenced, along with apprenticeships, as the policy proposal that was finally going to sort out that pesky inequality between the nations and regions of the UK. But it seems that when it comes to it, Northerners are a low priority for the Tories for infrastructure spending and improved transport links. The only thing less shocking than this reality would be the discovery of another Boris Johnson love child. This latest policy chaos is an interesting strategy for an unelected Prime Minister ahead of a party conference. Next week, the great and the gilded of the Conservative Party will gather in Manchester to prepare that everything is fine and they're not all stuck by a project of mutually assured destruction. Any attack lines that his speechwriters might have come up with for his big, set-piece address to conference have been neutralised by the Prime Minister's most recent displays of ineptitude. It would be a bit rich to point out that Keir Starmer is a flip-flopper when the Prime Minister has become such a dedicated proponent of the political U-turn. Any mention of the SNP's current woes over party finances will surely be drowned out by wry laughter as listeners across the UK think back over the past few years of Tory cronyism, dodgy dealings and outright political dysfunction. That's not to say that the Conservative Party conference won't be worth watching. We are beginning to see the first real signs of how the next general election will shape up. From everything that the Prime Minister has said and done in recent weeks, it seems he will pitch himself as a man who is prepared to be unpopular for the good of the country. The main flaw in that plan is that it is his party that has brought the UK to its knees, and he's already unpopular enough, even outside of a desperate policy announcements that appeal to people who live in the comments section of the Daily Mail online. And that column was by Kirsty Strickland. From The National, Monday the 25th of September, from the culture section, review. Unapologetic novel offers a delicate look at teen mental health. Review by Gemma E. McLaughlin, and this article was first published on the 24th of September. Suicide Notes, a novel by Michael Thomas Ford, published by Harper Teen. I was taken aback by this title when it arrived on my doorstep. This reaction is one I'm certain Michael Thomas Ford anticipated. A feeling of disquiet, a desire almost to avoid the uncomfortable, it is exactly the feeling that his writing forces you to confront on every page. The short, unapologetic novel, originally published in 2008, was sitting on top of a far thicker sequel, long anticipated by fans. Now I have read this, the original. I both understand the anticipation and feel it's time it was introduced to a new generation such as my own, who missed it the first time. Suicide Notes is a coming-of-age novel for those who may have once feared they never would. Though containing mature themes and best suited for those 14-plus in the way they're handled, as they relate to the main character Jeff's journey, is honest but never gratuitous, reminiscent of Stephen Chomsky's The Perks of Being a Wallflower, another unpatronising exploration of teen mental health. When Jeff wakes up in the psychiatric ward, he is absolutely certain it's a mistake. He's nothing like the young people around him who actually have something wrong with them. When the doctor and nurses won't accept that the bandages on his wrists are simply from a stupid mistake, he realises he's stuck in this place for 45 days. Each of these is a chapter in which the reader will both feel annoyed by and sympathetic towards Jeff, between the cruelty to those around him born of his own denial, and the genuinely witty observations of his surroundings. No matter what you're laughing at, though, there is a sense of skillful comedy throughout, one which refuses to trivialise the serious topics. Despite his instinct to be left alone, Jeff realises he must confront the issue that is one of the novel's main themes, his connection with those around him, from new friendships to some he wishes he could forget. As much as he insists he is vastly different from a similar group of teenagers in the ward, especially when they recount horrible stories of abuse, confusion and depression in group therapy, it is the little things he finds himself relating to. There is a surprising but attention-holding element of mystery to the story, which comes from Jeff's initial hesitation to invest in the programme and open up. Even the reader, who hears his every thought, jumping wildly from one to the next looking for distraction, is only able to pick up clues as to how he might have ended up in this place and what about himself he's trying to avoid and hide. Each day he lies to his psychiatrist, each sarcastic comment or lack of a letter from his best friend on the outside, Ali, makes his own thoughts harder to hide from. As he comes to confront these truths, it is not total catharsis but the start of another journey of recovery. This is a journey I, and other fans, new and old, can read now in the sequel, Every Star That Falls. And that review was by Gemma E. McLaughlin. From the National, Wednesday the 27th of September, from the Culture section, World's Oldest Whiskey Found Hidden in Blair Castle in Perthshire, by Lucy Jackson. One of the oldest whiskies in the world has been discovered hidden in a Scottish castle. The whiskey, believed to have been distilled in 1833 and bottled in 1841, was found behind a cellar door at a 750-year-old Blair Castle in Perthshire. Experts said the Scotch is one of the oldest in the world. Around 40 bottles of the whiskey were discovered in late 2022 by Bertie Troughton, resident trustee at Blair Castle. The age and origin of the whisky has been verified by research into the castle's archives, as well as carbon dating carried out by the Scottish University's Environmental Research Centre. Troughton said, discovering the story behind the bottles had been a wonderful experience. He said, Blair Castle is fortunate to have one of the best archives of any historic house in Scotland, and it's been wonderful to see the story of these fabulous bottles come to life in the archives. Whisky has always been a huge part of the history of Blair Castle, and we will be building an exhibition so that all who visit Blair Castle can see and hear the history of this incredible whisky. A total of 24 bottles will be auctioned individually between November the 24th and December the 4th by Perth-based business Whisky Auctioneer. Joe Wilson, head curator and spirit specialist at Whisky Auctioneer, called it a transcendent discovery, claiming that the bottles contain the world's oldest Scotch whisky. Wilson continued, I am fortunate to be well acquainted with old and rare liquid, as Whisky Auctioneer handles some of the world's rarest whisky bottlings. This, however, is a transcendent discovery that is sure to capture not just the imagination of the whisky industry, but also those well beyond. Distilled in the 1830s, the whisky was made during a fascinating period when whisky production was experiencing a massive change following the 1823 Excise Act, making it a particularly exciting find for those interested in the history and heritage of the Scotch whisky industry. Further information about the auction can be found online. From the National, Tuesday the 26th of September, from the Culture section, Pulp to headline Edinburgh's Hogmanay celebrations. Report by Adam Robertson. Pulp have been announced as the headline act for this year's Hogmanay celebrations in Edinburgh. Led by frontman Jarvis Cocker, the Sheffield band will bring in the bells against the backdrop of Edinburgh Castle. It follows a union and a summer tour which included a set at Transmit in Glasgow. Cocker said, when your grandkids asked, do you remember the first time Pulp played Edinburgh's Hogmanay? What will your answer be? He added, come along and start 2024 in the very best way possible. Oh yes. The band, who enjoyed great success in the 1990s with their album Different Class, picked up the Mercury Music Prize in 1996. Some of their biggest hits include Disco 2000, Common People and Do You Remember the First Time, which are all likely to be on the set list this Hogmanay. It will also mark the 30th anniversary of Edinburgh's Hogmanay Party, whose previous headliners have included Pet Shop Boys, Mark Ronson and Franz Ferdinand. Their performance will be broadcast on screens along Princes Street, where 40,000 revellers are expected for the Hogmanay Street Party. Tickets will go on sale on Friday morning and will cost £75. Organisers Unique Assembly have also promised live street theatre, drummers, pipers, vintage funfair rides and a carnival atmosphere in the city centre leading up to the bells. Reaching the milestone 30th anniversary for Edinburgh's Hogmanay is a phenomenal achievement, which since 1993 has welcomed millions of party people to celebrate at the home of Hogmanay, the director said. We wanted to make sure that this year was extra special for our audiences and are thrilled to welcome Pulp to the party. This will be the hottest ticket in town and we'd recommend people grab their tickets fast to make sure they don't miss out. They also confirmed that the Torchlight Procession, which returned on 29th of December, as well as the Night Before Disco Party beneath Edinburgh Castle on 30th of December. And that article was written by Adam Robertson.
From the National, on Tuesday the 26th of September 2023, from the Politics section. COVID restrictions had long-term impact on pregnant Scottish women. This article was written by Abby Garton-Crosby. COVID-19 restrictions in Scotland had long-term consequences for women who were pregnant or gave birth during the pandemic, a report has said. In Gender and the Health and Social Care Allegiance in Scotland, published a report settling out the experience of women accessing pregnancy and maternity services between March 2020 and November 2022. Trauma, abandonment and isolation, experiences of pregnancy and maternity services in Scotland during COVID-19, draws on survey responses from over 200 women across Scotland. It found the public health restrictions during the pandemic had a profound and negative impact on women, from antenatal care, fertility treatment, to miscarriage and baby loss, birth and the postnatal period. The report particularly found that the need for women to be isolated while undergoing invasive procedures and also prior to, during and after birth had an adverse impact. Restrictions in place meant that partners had to leave immediately after birth and many women spent a large portion of their labour alone, described as difficult and frightening by respondents. The report reads, findings reveal that the standard of care that women received was insufficient, with participants highlighting a lack of in-person support and antenatal provision, poor attitudes and treatment of staff, and the impact of staff capacity on care and treatment. Information on COVID-19 in relation to pregnancy and related services was significantly lacking, including with regard to the vaccine and the exacerbated anxiety for many. Jill Wood, policy manager at Engender, said, "This research indicates that COVID-19 guidance and its application fundamentally failed to take into account the woman's diverse needs and experiences during pregnancy and early motherhood. Confusing and contradictory communication, lack of in-person care and support, inflexible restrictions and inconsistent approaches across health board areas all undermined access to safe, dignified and quality healthcare. The trauma caused by attending procedures and giving birth alone and the subsequent isolation, lack of support, adequate care will stay with women long into the future. The Scottish Government must learn from this, improve maternal health more broadly and deliver on commitments on women's health." The report's key findings set out how the shift away from in-person care to remote appointments was a barrier to adequate standards of care. There was also a narrow focus on labour and delivery, overlooking others' needs such as mental health and breastfeeding support, the report added. Jane Miller, Academy Programme Manager at Allegiant, said, pregnancy and early parenthood can be challenging at the best of times. Our research shows that mitigation measures brought in during the pandemic exacerbated isolation and anxiety for many women in Scotland. There is now an urgent need to centre the experience and priorities of women in the ongoing COVID-19 inquiry and in the development of any future emergency guidance regarding health care. We must mitigate the risk of isolation and adopt flexible personal treatment approaches grounded in human rights and gender equality. One participant in the research said that it was essential that Scotland learn from people's experiences during the pandemic to improve maternity services and public health messaging. To do otherwise would be to fail and further compound the trauma of thousands of parents over the last few years, they added. Gendered health inequalities such as pain management and lack of an intersectional approach were also found to have been exacerbated by the pandemic. The report will be submitted as evidence to the Scottish COVID inquiry and sets out a series of recommendations, particularly the need for a gendered and human rights approach to crisis management, particularly that women's particular experiences are taken into account. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, the Scottish Government is cooperating fully with the COVID-19 inquiry and the Scottish COVID inquiry and will follow along with all the evidence given closely. We support both inquiries in their work to explore the handling of the pandemic and to identify the vital lessons we all need to learn. It would not be appropriate to comment on detailed evidence presented to either inquiry at this stage. And that article was written by Abby Garton Crosby. From The National, on Tuesday the 26th of September, 2023. From the Politics section. Suella Braverman claims multiculturalism has failed in extreme speech. And this article was written by Judith Duffy. Suella Braverman has been attacked over deeply ignorant and offensive comments after a speech in which she claimed multiculturalism has failed in Europe and threatens social cohesion. Delivering a speech in Washington, D.C., the Home Secretary also spoke of the UK's resources being stretched thin due to illegal migration, due to high birth rates among foreign-born mothers. She also highlighted threats to public safety, noting heightened levels of criminality connected to small boat arrivals. The SNP called for her to retract her comments and issue an urgent apology, saying it proves once again she is unfit for office. In the speech to the American Enterprise Institute think tank in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, the Home Secretary said multiculturalism has failed in Europe and threatens social cohesion in the nation state. She said uncontrolled immigration, inadequate integration, and a misguided dogma of multiculturalism has proven a toxic combination for Europe over the last few decades. She said multiculturalism has failed because it allowed people to come to our society and live parallel lives in it, and even pursue lives aimed at undermining the stability and threatening the security of our society. Migration to the UK and Europe in the last 25 years has been too much too quick, with too little thought given to integration and the impact on social cohesion, she said. If cultural change is too rapid and too big, then what is already there is diluted. Eventually, it will disappear. It does not make one anti-immigrant to say the nation state must be protected, Braverman claimed, pointing to her own background as a child of immigrants. Braverman also said the UK's resources were being stretched thin due to illegal migration. She told the audience, unless countries can prevent or rapidly remove illegal migrants, pressures on the state will compound over time. Accommodation cannot be magicked out of thin air. Braverman said, thousands of extra places in schools will need to be created due to high birth rates among foreign-born mothers. People who choose to come across the channel legally from another safe country have already showed contempt for our laws, she said. Asked during a Q&A session afterwards if she would consider leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, if it is too difficult to reform, Braverman said, just because multilateral negotiations are difficult, it's not a reason not to engage with international partners who are grappling with similar challenges and asking elemental questions about whether the frameworks are fit for purpose. And so I am seeking to build consensus internationally. The Prime Minister himself said, "We will do whatever it takes to stop the boats." And that's my position. And that illustrates the resolve, the intent, and the commitment of the UK's government to fix this problem, whatever is required. On the Rwanda plan being stuck in the courts, she said, "I am confident in the lawfulness of our agreement." SNP Justice and Immigration spokesperson Chris Stevens, MP, said, "The Home Secretary's comments today are deeply ignorant and offensive, proving once again that she is unfit for office. She must retract her comments and issue an urgent apology. Our immigration system should welcome with open arms women or LGBT plus people who are fleeing war-torn countries or places where they face persecution. Instead, the Tories and the Labour Party are too concerned with their obsession of deporting and dehumanising refugees." Instead of attacking the rights of refugees, the Home Secretary should be addressing the real issues in the asylum system, such as the record backlog, providing safe routes for those in need of protection, including refugee visas, resettlement and family reunion schemes. While Scotland remains under the control of a cruel Westminster immigration system, refugees and asylum seekers in our communities will continue to face hardship and anxiety. The only way to guarantee that Scotland's immigration system is based on the values of fairness and dignity is with the full powers of an independent country. And that article was written by Judith Duffy.
The National News on Wednesday, the 27th of September. Comics' insane journey to Scotland posts go viral. An article written by Xander Elliots. A stand-up comedian's social media post has gone viral after he described his insane 11-hour journey to Scotland, which ended at 3:30 a.m. after a ridiculous taxi ride. James Nokise said he was among hundreds of people ordered off an Avanti West Coast train at Preston Station in Lancashire on Monday night, with passengers apparently told of the cancellation via email even before the staff on board. The train company arranged for taxis to take them to their Edinburgh destination, more than 3 hours away. Mr. Nokise was driven to the Scottish capital with three other people in a black cab. In a series of posts viewed more than 2.6 million times on X, formerly Twitter, he wrote, "At 4:40 p.m. I jumped on a train from London to Edinburgh. It was comfy, it was quiet. In hindsight, it was too good to last." Mr. Nokise said that at 7:26 p.m. he was among the passengers who received an email stating that the train was cancelled. He tweeted, "This was a surprise because A, I was still on a moving train, and B, there had been no announcement on the moving train." An announcement was then made that the service was terminating at Preston, but that another train to Glasgow was being held to take those on board to Scotland. But the Glasgow-bound train was full and left Preston as Mr. Nokise and his fellow passengers arrived. They were told to wait for the next train, which was also then cancelled. Mr. Nokise wrote, "It turned out there were no more trains north after that, and excitingly, no forthcoming information. No one knew anything." Around 9:20 p.m, news came down. Alternative transport had been arranged. A bus, an extra train, horses, taxis, for hundreds of people, to a city 3.5 hours away. At 10:30 p.m, he was in the final group of travellers to get in a cab, describing the situation as ridiculous. He wrote, "Except we weren't all going to Edinburgh because it wasn't an express train. Some were going to Glasgow, some to Dundee, some to Carlisle, and some to other stops. But all of us queued to be taken away 3 to 7 people at a time. And if that sounds slow and ridiculous, it was." The comic wrote that shortly after midnight, our cabbie decided to change lanes without indicating and almost crashed into a minivan overtaking him. Mr. Nokise expressed sympathy with the cabbie, who stopped to buy 2 cans of energy drink, as it's late, it's a dark highway, and he's driving a city black cab not meant for this road. He added, perhaps, just possibly, throwing money at cab drivers and getting them to drive several hours in the middle of the night might not be the best contingency plan for train companies to have. The A72 is a real motion sickness nightmare of a road, which is narrow, dark, full of turns and occasionally just dips, he wrote. During the taxi journey, Mr. Nokise received an email from Avanti West Coast informing him he would receive £70 compensation, which was how much his ticket cost. After being dropped off at Edinburgh Waverley Station at around 3 a.m, he had to take another taxi to his accommodation. In his final post on the trip, he wrote at 3:30 a.m, "Thanks for being on this journey with me, Twitter. A truly insane odyssey. 5 hours late, 11 hours after I jumped on the train. I'm going to have a shower and eat something. Let's never do this again." An Avanti West Coast spokesperson said, "We apologise to our customers who were caught up in last night's disruption. The closure of the West Coast main line for over 3 hours due to a track defect had a significant impact on our services, with trains and train crew unable to work our planned timetable, resulting in cancellations of services north of Preston. Whilst alternative transport and overnight accommodation was sourced for most of those impacted, we fully understand the frustrations of those customers whose journeys were affected, and we're extremely sorry for this. Anyone who was affected by last night's disruption will be entitled to compensation and are urged to get in contact through our normal channels to process their claim." An article written by Xander Elliots. The National News on Wednesday, the 27th of September. Crews enter a third day tackling a blaze in Ayr as ScotRail issues a travel update. An article written by Adam Robertson. A third teenager has been charged following a blaze at a historic station hotel in Ayr. It comes as firefighters spend a third day tackling the fire at Ayr Station Hotel, which is expected to disrupt rail services for days. Multiple crews were sent to the scene in Ayr when the alarm was raised shortly after 5:30 p.m. on Monday, with 15 appliances there at the height of the incident. The Scottish Fire and Rescue Service said there were still appliances at the scene on Wednesday morning. In a post on X, formerly known as Twitter, ScotRail said, "Due to the ongoing incident near Ayr Station, we're not expecting to be able to run services to or from Ayr Station." It said multiple shuttles and coaches were running and encouraged people to plan their journeys ahead of time. Police said on Wednesday that a 13-year-old male has been arrested and charged in connection with the incident, and a report will be sent to the relevant authority. Two male youths, aged 17 and 13, have already been arrested and charged in connection with alleged fire-raising following the incident. They'll both be reported to the relevant authorities, and further inquiries are ongoing. It's the second fire this year at the derelict building. Two teenagers were charged by police following a blaze there in May. A number of roads in the town are closed as emergency services continue to deal with the latest incident. An article written by Adam Robertson. Glasgow Times News on Wednesday, the 27th of September. Screen star David McCallum dies, aged 90. An article written by Andrew Smart. Scottish-born actor David McCallum, who is known for starring in hit shows like NCIS and The Man from U.N.C.L.E., has died at the age of 90. The news of his passing in New York was confirmed by the Glasgow star's family on Monday evening, with them remembering him as a loving father. The actor is best known for playing a secret agent in the 1960s spy drama The Man from U.N.C.L.E., but has gained recent popularity for his role as a pathologist on the hit CBS show NCIS. David McCallum also featured heavily on the big screen, seeing him star in films like The Great Escape, The Greatest Story Ever Told, and A Night to Remember. Before entering the film and television industry, Mr. McCallum initially pursued a career in music, following in the footsteps of his parents, who were both classical musicians. In a statement, his family shared that the celebrity actor was a true Renaissance man. His son, Peter McCallum, added, "He was the kindest, coolest, most patient and loving father. he always put family before self. He was fascinated by science and culture and would turn those passions into knowledge. For example, he was capable of conducting a symphony orchestra and, if needed, could actually perform an autopsy based on his decades-long studies for his role on NCIS. CBS also released a statement praising the star as a gifted actor and author. The statement added, "He led an incredible life, and his legacy will forever live on through his family and the countless hours on film and television that will never go away." An article written by Andrew Smart. The National News on Wednesday, the 27th of September. Flood warning as Scotland braces for the impact of Storm Agnes. An article written by Xander Elliots. Scotland could face flooding and other disruption, where the scientists have warned ahead of the arrival of Storm Agnes. The Met Office has issued weather warnings with strong winds and heavy rain set to cause floods, power cuts and to tear down trees. The first named storm of the season could batter the UK on Wednesday with winds of up to 75 miles an hour and cause dangerous conditions along coastlines. The Met Office has issued a yellow wind weather warning from midday on Wednesday to 7 a.m. on Thursday, stretching across Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. The weather warning also covers the southwest of England, the West Midlands and most of the north of England. Two yellow rain warnings are also in place covering areas of Scotland, and the Met Office has said there could be up to 60 millimetres of rain within the warning areas. Storm Agnes will hit the UK and Ireland on Wednesday, with the most powerful winds expected on the Irish Sea coasts. Gusts of up to 75 miles an hour are expected on higher ground and exposed coastal areas, with inland areas forecast to see gusts of 45 to 50 miles an hour. The storm could cause power cuts, blow tiles from roofs and disrupt railways and roads, the Met Office has warned on its website. The Scottish Environment Protection Agency, or SEPA, has warned that the storm could cause flooding. Flood duty manager David Morgan said, "Flooding impacts are possible, particularly in southwest and central areas of Scotland. Along the southwest coast, we may see wave overtopping and flooding of causeways, promenades, properties and roads. Impacts are expected to be localised and around high tide. We may also see minor flooding impacts from surface water and rivers. Flood alerts and warnings are being issued as necessary, and we continue to work with the Met Office to monitor the situation." Met Office spokesperson Ollie Claydon also warned that the storm could knock trees over and disrupt the Irish Sea ferry network. He told the PA news agency, "The storm centre itself remains over the Atlantic and will continue approaching and cross the UK through Wednesday afternoon and will move away Wednesday night into Thursday. In terms of most impacted areas, we're looking at the Irish Sea coasts, so southeastern parts of Northern Ireland, west and northwestern coasts of Wales and the northwestern coast of England." The Royal National Lifeboat Institution, or RNLI, has warned that the forecasted storm is likely to cause dangerous conditions on the coasts around the UK and in Ireland. RNLI water safety partner Sam Hughes said, "The RNLI advises staying a safe distance away from the water and from cliff edges, as the conditions could knock you off your feet or wash you into the sea. It's not worth risking your life. If you see someone else in danger in the water, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard. If you have something that floats that they can hold on to, throw it to them. Don't go into the water yourself. You may end up in difficulty too." An article written by Xander Elliots. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 27th of September. Humza Yousaf slams Suella Braverman's extreme speech. An article written by James Walker. Humza Yousaf has slammed Suella Braverman after a speech where she warned of the existential threat of uncontrolled migration. The Home Secretary used a speech in the United States on Tuesday to advocate for the United Nations Refugee Convention to be overhauled as part of wider efforts to stop small boats crossing the Channel. She also attacked multiculturalism, adding that the UK's resources were being stretched thin due to illegal migration and high birth rates among foreign-born mothers. But in a rebuke to the senior Conservative, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the organisation's refugee agency, denied that there was any need for reform. The First Minister said it was a reminder that the UK government will throw refugees under the bus for cheap, narrow political gain. For shame, he added. Responding to a tweet from the United Nations agency reaffirming the principles of the Refugee Convention, he said, "The fact that the United Nations Refugee Agency has put out a statement like this on the back of the Home Secretary's statement is a reminder of how the UK government has completely lost its way. It will throw refugees under the bus for cheap, narrow political gain. For shame." In her speech, Ms. Braverman said the current international framework governing refugee status, including the UN Accord, was contributing to a system that was incentivising millions of asylum seekers to try their luck. Calling for the definition of who qualifies for protection under refugee rules to be tightened, she said the threshold for asylum had steadily been lowered since the signing of the UN Pact, which is backed by 149 states, more than 70 years ago. In comments criticised by equalities campaigners and charities, she said offering asylum to a person because they're discriminated against in their home country for being gay or a woman was not sustainable. She described the interpretive shift away from persecution in favour of something more akin to a definition of discrimination, as well as a similar shift away from a well-founded fear towards a credible or plausible fear. The Home Secretary said the consequences of these shifts had been to expand the number of people who might qualify for asylum and to lower the threshold for doing so. She went on, "Let me be clear, there are vast swathes of the world where it's extremely difficult to be gay or a woman. Where individuals are being persecuted, it's right that we offer sanctuary. But we will not be able to sustain an asylum system if, in effect, simply being gay or a woman and fearful of discrimination in your country of origin is sufficient to qualify for protection." But the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which released a statement shortly after her speech, said there is no need for reform or any more restrictive interpretation, but for a stronger and more consistent application of the Convention and its underlying principle of responsibility sharing. The Refugee Agency said the Refugee Convention remains as relevant today as when it was adopted, and added, "Where individuals are at risk of persecution on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity, it is crucial that they are able to seek safety and protection." Ms. Braverman also spoke of the UK's resources being stretched thin due to illegal migration, due to high birth rates among foreign-born mothers, comments which were heavily condemned. She also highlighted threats to public safety, noting heightened levels of criminality connected to some small boat arrivals. The SNP has called for her to retract her comments and issue an urgent apology, saying it proves, once again, she is unfit for office. An article written by James Walker. The National News on Wednesday, the 27th of September. Scottish greenhouse gas emissions up amid COVID-19 pandemic recovery. An article written by Lucy Jackson. Greenhouse gas emissions in Scotland increased by 4% due to industry recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, figures show. Statistics released by the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency, or SEPA, Scotland's environmental regulator, showed the total greenhouse gas levels in Scotland were 10.5 megatons in 2022, up from 10.1 the previous year. However, the emissions for 2023 are 7.3% lower than pre-pandemic levels of 11.4 megatons. David Pirrie, Executive Director of SEPA, said that the annual data is a very visual demonstration of the progress we're making as a nation. He continued, "There is a strong relationship between our environment and our economy, and meeting Scotland's climate targets will require a collective effort from all sectors." CEPA's annual Scottish Pollution Release Inventory estimates the global warming potential of the emissions to have increased by 2.7% since 2021, but the 2022 rate is 0.93 megatons less than 2019, showing a longer-term downward trend. The findings also show that the energy sector remains the highest emitter in Scotland, accounting for 44.7% of overall greenhouse gas emissions. The sector reported a 7.2% increase in 2022 due to production demand, and output was responsible for 47.1% of overall carbon dioxide emissions, 10.7% of methane, and 78.3% of nitrous oxide. Analysis from the regulator suggests that the increase was caused by an industry bounce back after construction, manufacturing and mining firms were impacted by pandemic restrictions. Mr. Pirrie continued, "As Scotland's environmental regulator, CEPA's firm focus remains on ensuring Scottish businesses are compliant with permit conditions designed to protect the environment and supporting innovation. We've all got a role to play in tackling climate change, and the continued reduction of greenhouse gas emissions from Scottish businesses is vital in helping our country reach net zero." An article written by Lucy Jackson.
From the National, Thursday the 28th of September, from the news section, BBC host cuts off SNP MP as he brings up Dan Wootton's investigation. By Adam Robertson. An SNP MP was cut off during a BBC interview when he brought up the Byline Times investigation into suspended GB News presenter Dan Wootton. The broadcaster previously admitted to errors of judgment in the past on his show, amid reports he offered media colleagues thousands of pounds for explicit material of themselves. However, he also denied any criminality and said he was the victim of a witch hunt by nefarious players. Wootton was suspended from the GB News on Wednesday following comments made by Lawrence Fox about journalist Ava Evans on his show. During an interview with Radio 4 about GB News, SNP MP John Nicholson started to say he was very interested in the investigation by Byline Times and described it as a very good piece of journalism. However, host Evan Davis interrupted and said, "I don't want to go into unrelated issues." Nicholson tried to continue to make his point, but Davis continued to speak over him and then asked, "Is there a danger in your position that the Ofcom are kind of, you're wanting Ofcom to censor channels that take opinions and give platform to opinions that you really don't like?" The MP replied, "I don't want censorship. I want Ofcom to enforce its own rules. And the point I was going to make is you said that the channel had responded by suspending Dan Wootton. And the point I was going to make was that there had been serious accusations about Dan Wootton for some time, which had received remarkably little coverage in the press, and which are worthy of investigation." Davis said that was not what we were discussing, but Nicholson then replied, "Well, it's relevant, because he's a presenter on the channel, and he's now been suspended." The host then ended the conversation and said, "We'll leave it there." And that report was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 28th of September, from the news section, BBC's Nick Robinson blames news avoiders for falling ratings, by Adam Robertson. BBC presenter Nick Robinson has blamed the Radio 4's Today programme's falling listening figures on news avoiders who don't want to face the world's problems. The news and current affairs show has lost more than 1 million listeners over the course of the past year. However, Robinson and co-presenter Amal Rajan insisted the slump was down to a general decline rather than dissatisfaction with the Today Show specifically. Speaking to the Radio Times, Robinson said, "People just want to avoid the news. Market research literally calls them news avoiders. We will all know people who think, I just can't face the world anymore." Rajan, meanwhile, pointed to a recent Reuters Institute report that showed a precipitous drop in interest. However, although the Today programme's audience fell to its lowest audience since 1999, 5.76 million listeners, ratings for other channels, including GB News and Times Radio, rose over the same period. The report which Rajan referenced which surveyed people in a range of countries, found some are turning away from coverage of the war in Ukraine, climate change and politics. It suggested that less sensationalist, less negative and more explanatory approaches might help to tempt back listeners. BBC insiders, however, have suggested the programme's problems run deeper than a general loss of interest in the news. One former Today employee told The Telegraph, "Today has been cut to the bone as part of all the cost-cutting in news, and it no longer has the editorial independence it once had, because so many things are certainly commissioned. That shows. And the programme has lost its mojo. When was the last time you were gripped by an interview with a member of the cabinet? Mind you, that may be due to the calibre of the cabinet ministers." Robinson and Rajan are now launching the Today podcast, as they hope to bring in a wider audience. On the new podcast, Robinson told The Telegraph, "Tone is important. Being friendly, not being overly aggressive for the sake of it. It's optimism, hope as well as scepticism and scrutiny. It's recognising that people are listening in this incredible, more intimate way. So that you don't want Judd to bitch just be like, oh shut up, stop shouting at each other." He also gave his thoughts on podcast The News Agents, hosted by Emily Maitlis and John Sopel, and The Rest is Politics, with Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, suggesting they follow similar templates to one another. A lot of people I know listen to that and really like having their own worldview reinforced to them, Robinson said. "We're not centrist dads." Rajan said the programme now better reflects the country because it has a range of accents rather than all the presenters speaking in received pronunciation. Both rejected rumours that the Today presenting team did not get along with one another. "We're very different, but you could smell it a mile off if people didn't get on," said Robinson. Rajan said, "I'm full of unashamed love for Today. I'm also full of love for the BBC. I read the absolute filth and nonsense that's written about it, devoid of understanding and context and nuance and all the rest of it, but I actually think there's a lot to be grateful for." And that report was by Adam Robertson. From The National, Thursday the 28th of September, from the politics section, Scottish Government Minister defends Fergus Ewing's suspension, by political reporter Hamish Morrison. Suspending rebel SNP MSP Fergus Ewing from the party group at Holyrood was proportionate, a senior member of the Scottish Government has insisted. Net Zero Secretary Murray McCallan backed the proposed 7-day suspension of the former Rural Affairs Secretary, who has been a fierce critic of Hamza Yousaf's government in recent months. The suspension, which Ewing has 2 weeks to appeal against, was approved after he voted with the opposition at Holyrood in a favour of no confidence against Scottish Green co-leader and government minister, Lorna Slater. Ewing has also spoken out against the Scottish Government on issues such as the new licensing regime for short-term rental properties, the failure to dual the A9, and plans, now shelved, to ban fishing in a tenth of Scottish waters. Speaking about his stance, the veteran MSP said afterwards, "I choose to defend my constituents' interests and let the cards fall where they may." His comments came after the meeting of SNP MSPs at Holyrood on Wednesday night resulted in a vote of 48-9 in favour of Ewing's suspension. SNP MP Joanna Cherry, however, claimed his rebellion was the product of years of inadequate debate in our party about policy making. In a statement posted on social media, Cherry, who has criticised the Scottish Government's policy on gendered recognition reform, said, "I may not agree with Fergus Ewing on everything, but he's a man of integrity. I'm glad there were rebels in this vote. His rebellion is the product of years of inadequate debate in our party about policy making. That needs to change. Don't shoot the messenger." But, speaking on BBC Radio Scotland's Good Morning Scotland programme on Thursday, McCallan said there is still room for free thinkers within the SNP. Asked if she had voted in favour of his suspension, McCallan said, "In full transparency, yes I did. It is something I certainly would expect to be the outcome if I had done what Fergus did. It is part of a normal party mechanism in a democratic system." Asked whether politicians can express their opinions within the SNP, she added, "Of course, I like to think of myself as a free thinker. in particular, the First Minister has been quite clear he wants people to come to him and to speak to him internally if they have any concerns they wish to raise. He has an open door in that regard. But Fergus is a long-standing MSP. He has been a minister. He understands the procedures here and what the outcome is of voting the way he did. McCallan also made clear she did not agree with Cherry's comments, adding that suspending Ewing was a proportionate response to a serious breach of party standing orders, which was voted on by majority, overwhelming majority, by the group in Holyrood. And that was a political piece by political reporter Hamish Morrison. From the National, Thursday the 28th of September, from the politics section. U-turn as Labour end pledge to drop private schools' charitable status. By multimedia journalist Adam Robertson. Private schools would retain some of their tax breaks under a Labour government as the party U-turned on its pledge to strip them of charitable status. Labour have said they no longer need to end the charitable status of private schools to achieve their policy of charging 20% VAT on fees and ending business rates relief in England, as first revealed by the I newspaper. This means that being able to claim gifted on donations and not paying tax on annual profits, which must be reinvested in education, will still be among the tax breaks that the charitable status confers. A Labour spokesman said, "Our policy remains. We will remove the unfair tax breaks that private schools benefit from to fund desperately needed teachers and mental health counselling in every secondary school." This doesn't require removing charitable status. However, driving high and rising standards for every child, against the backdrop of a broken economy, requires political choices. Labour isn't afraid to make them. The latest move contradicts comments made in 2021 by Rachel Reeves, who said at the time, "Here's the truth. Private schools are not charities, and so we will end that exemption and put that money straight into our state schools. That is what a Labour government will do." However, the chief executive of the Independent Schools Council, Julie Robertson, remained critical of the move. They said, "If Labour takes away the tax relief associated with charitable status for independent schools, the policy would create a two-tier system within the charity sector, setting a worrying precedent that any charity seen as not reflecting the political ideology of the day could be subject to additional taxes. We would love to work with Labour to build more effective ways to achieve our shared goal of improving education for all young people." Labour's policy costings only ever took into account charging VAT on schools' fees and ending the business rates exemption rather than other tax breaks. However, Shadow Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson had previously spoken of scrapping charitable tax status for private schools to fund the most ambitious state school improvement plan in a generation. The Tories have accused Labour of having U-turned. Chief Secretary to the Treasury John Glenn said, "Labour has been forced to U-turn on one of their major policies, this time admitting that their school tax hike just doesn't work." Keir Starmer is clearly only interested in short-term policies designed to grab headlines without any regard for the consequences, and inevitably has flip-flopped on them. And that article was by Adam Robertson. From the National, Thursday the 28th of September, from the comment section, "Women's voices are being stifled by political inaction," by Kelly Giffen. Standing for election has never been a particularly easy endeavour, but for women in Scotland in 2023, amid a rise of relentless online abuse and harassment, it's seldom been harder. In a trend that threatens the very essence of democracy, women who are brimming with potential and fresh perspectives are more hesitant than ever to stand for elected office in Scotland. Their number one reason? Fear of relentless online harassment at the hands of deranged internet bullies. People who dedicate their entire lives to posting bile on the internet and seemingly not much else. We're often told as women in this space to simply ignore, to not engage, that if we don't feed them, they will get bored and find another woman to hound. The 2020 strain of victim blaming. As if harassment is to be expected or is some obscure alien problem that cannot possibly be tackled. Because God forbid people had to be held accountable for their actions. Any woman who has fallen victim to the now well-identifiable faction of Scotpol school billies would argue that when you're being harassed by hundreds upon hundreds of accounts, to the point that your notification feeds are swarmed, or your life has been threatened by an anonymous, fully grown man online, it's not easily ignored, and nor should it be. The impact of online abuse is not hypothetical, it has real consequences. Not only is that experience trivialised in such a way, there's very little the police can actually do to help, and it soberingly lays bare holes in harassment law. Women are chronically failed by the criminal justice system. Online abuse and harassment is just another in a long line of failures to add to the list. We merely have to hope that these people are all fart and no poo, and that they won't actually turn up at our door and try to kill us. A plan of action that does really very little to quell the crippling fear and anxiety that experience brings. You might ask, and where are the political parties? You'd think that given the delve into the social media age, and how politics has managed to adapt so seamlessly to it, much to its advantage in fact, there might be some sort of protections in place, or even thoughts hashed out about how political machines might protect their candidates, or indeed anyone at all, who wants to partake in democracy. But you'd be wrong. When I reached out to my party amid the first batch of hellish online abuse I received, I didn't even get a response, let alone any concrete advice on how to handle it. Collectively, the duty of care has been shirked across the board. Parties have no idea how to get a handle on this, so they're casually ignoring it and hoping for the best. A tactic I can't warn against enough, because someone will be to blame when one of these people makes good their threats. I'd actually argue that they are complicit in it. I feel resentment for the fact that these online factions have been allowed to spiral out of control in the face of inaction for so long that the problem now feels insurmountable. I have spent time recently, as I often do, with a whole host of talented, politically engaged women. The vast majority of whom have told me they don't want to run and won't be putting themselves forward for election next year. Not because they don't want to or have nothing to offer, but because it's not worth the harassment that they would face. Not in a letting bullies win kind of way, but from the completely valid perspective that we are all as human beings entitled to our peace, privacy and quality of life. A life where you don't have to worry that the anonymous troll who said you should be given a bullet is actually that man walking across the street from you. And elected politics robs women of it all. For women, frontline politics requires a relinquishing of freedom that is no way expected of men. For an increasing number, it's unfortunately too high a price to pay for a seat at the table. And for as long as political powers take no action, women's voices will continue to be stifled in public life. One of the many reasons this has spiralled in the way it has is that politics is still deeply male-dominated. Even the Scottish Parliament, while better than the UK Parliament, hasn't seen nearly enough progress towards gender balance since it was established, and none of the major parties have fully gender balanced their candidates. The Greens are leading the way so far, and at the last Scottish Parliament election, 49% of the candidates they fielded were women. Interesting, isn't it, that women are being hounded away and discouraged from public life, all the while the men within it tell them to ignore it as if it were a mere irritation, and the structures that are supposed to support them turn their backs and pretend they can't see. Call me a conspiracist, but it looks especially to me like patriarchy in action. Almost as if the oppression of women is a man-made, pardon the pun, intentional, systemic problem or something. If only we could come up with some solutions. Scotland has a rich history of political engagement, and it's one of the things I find myself most proud of as a Scot. The political energy we have is special and not to be taken for granted, but I fear women are starting to take a step back, a trend that we will only see continue for as long as nothing is put in place as support. This rise in online misogyny is starting to really bleed into real life. Just yesterday, in one of the most harrowing examples of this I've seen yet, a 15-year-old girl was stabbed to death in broad daylight for rejecting a peer. The Andrew Tate toxic masculinity era is, unsurprisingly, creating an increasingly unsafe and anxiety-filled existence for women everywhere. The last place we need that to penetrate is our political life. If women are to have a chance at equality in any branch of society, we must have a seat at the table, and it must be safe for us to pursue that seat. And that column was by Kelly Giffen.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hear and Review. Tell your friends about our service.